From PRI, Public Radio International, it's The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. Raymond Chandler is famous for creating the noir genre of literary fiction. But the fact of the matter is he wrote detective stories.
I mean, that's like calling Blade Runner a sci-fi movie.
Oh, I'm sorry, but Blade Runner is a science fiction movie. It's also much more than that. And that's the point. What should we call those extraordinary works of genre fiction that show just how much you can achieve within a genre? You'll hear various opinions this hour, from Richard Price to fellow novelist Michael Chabon, a champion of Chandler's Philip Marlowe.
I love hard-boiled detective fiction. There's been no greater guide to the world of Los Angeles than Philip Marlowe.
My name is Marlowe, Philip Marlowe. Occupation, private detective. You know, somebody says, follow that guy. So I follow him. Somebody says, find that female. So I find her. And what do I get out of it? $10 a day in expenses. And if you think that buys a lot of fancy groceries these days, you're crazy. Right now, you're reading in your newspapers and hearing over your radios about a murder. They call it the Case of the Lady in the Lake. It's a good title. It fits. What you've read and what you've heard is one thing. The real thing is something else. There's only one guy who knows that. I know it. This Lady in the Lake business started just 3 days before Christmas. I was tired of being pushed around for nickels and dimes, so I decided I'd write about murder. It's safer. You know, some cases of murder start when that door there behind you opens up and a fellow rushes in, all covered with sweat and confusion, and fills you full of bad dope about the setup. But some cases, like this one, kind of creep up on you on their hands and knees. And the first thing you know, you're in it up to your neck. You'll see it just as I saw it. You'll meet the people, you'll find the clues, and maybe you'll solve it quick, and maybe you won't. You think you will, eh? Okay, you're smart. But let me give you a tip. You've got to watch them. You've got to watch them all the time. Because things happen when you least expect them.
Robert Montgomery as Philip Marlowe in the opening scene of The Lady in the Lake, released in 1946. By then, Raymond Chandler, who wrote the novel on which the film was based, had created the noir fiction genre and an indelible portrait of Los Angeles. He'd arrived in the city back in 1912.
I think it was really a kind of paradise. I think it was being discovered by Midwesterners who could take a train out here and spend the winter or spend a few weeks in this extraordinary place.
Novelist Judith Freeman lives in one of Raymond Chandler's old neighborhoods. When she began to realize just how many of them there were, over 30 within the city limits, Freeman decided to visit them all. The result is a book, The Long Embrace, Raymond Chandler and the Woman He Loved. Anne Strainchamp spent summers in L.A. when she was younger, so she told Judith Freeman how much she'd enjoyed tracing Chandler's path.
Chandler came to know Los Angeles very well, in part for a kind of puzzling phenomenon. He moved incredibly often.
It's true. He early on established a pattern of moving very often, and it's one of the things that prompted me to want to write the book, is that when I was reading his letters, I realized the addresses were constantly changing at the top. And I think that that's one of the reasons why he ended up getting L.A. and writing about it so well, putting it on the map in terms of literature, was because he literally knew it from all of these different angles.
He did a lot of different things. He worked in the oil industry, worked as an accountant. He didn't begin to write till a little bit later in his life, and he set about it really surprisingly deliberately. He just sort of decided to teach himself to write.
Exactly. He was working as an accountant for an oil company. He was fired right at the end of the Depression, and he started reading what were known as the pulp magazines. I think it was really brilliant in a way because Chandler was a real intellectual with a classical education, and he had very high standards for himself. And like many intellectuals, they often block themselves from really being able to write because they can never satisfy these very high standards they have for literature. When Chandler discovered the pulp fiction stories in Black Mask, he found them, you know, really engaging. They had vitality, and he thought he could write a story like that and maybe even write it better. So he thought he would give it a try, and he really felt like the way to learn to write was that you had to study and emulate other writers. So he looked at Hammett and Hemingway and Earl Stanley Gardner. And he was, he was a kind of brilliant mimic. He mastered the idea of the plot and the techniques. But then he brought something else to this form, which was a tremendous sense of wit and style, and also a real feeling for the American vernacular, for the slang. American English fascinated him. And he also created this extraordinary sense of atmosphere. And these were new things.
The subtitle of your book is Raymond Chandler and the Woman He Loved. So we should talk some about the woman in his life. It was a fascinating relationship with his wife, Sissy. How did she enter his life, and how much do we know about her?
We know very little about her, in part because he burned all of her letters shortly before he died in 1959. And when he did that, he almost obliterated her. There's so little information about Sissy that former biographers have always called her an enigma. She's unknowable. Very few people met her. They were very reclusive as a couple for much of their married life. He met her at a party in the 19-teens at the house of the couple he had met on the boat that brought him to America. She was married at that time to a composer. He fell in love with her. Eventually, he wooed her away from her husband. He was living with his mother at the time. He knew she was older, but he didn't really know how much older. And when they finally were married 2 weeks after his mother died in 1924, he was 35 years old and she was 53, but she listed her age as 43 on the marriage certificate. So it was some time before Chandler really figured out he had married a woman much older than he thought, a woman who actually was much closer to his mother's age.
Do you think that was part of the appeal?
I do. I think that Chandler was a kind of shy and insecure young man, and I think Sissy was an immensely witty and attractive middle-aged woman who was on her second husband when he met her, and I think she presented him with this very attractive proposition. Here was an older woman, confident, worldly, sexy, experienced. I think that it was a very passionate relationship in the beginning, that he was immensely attracted to her.
It's interesting because you wouldn't necessarily think that when you think that he married a woman old enough to be his mother, you'd think maybe it was a very domestic, very comfortable relationship, perhaps not a highly sexed relationship, and yet from the sound of it, it was an extremely sexually charged relationship.
I think it became what you described later, a wonderfully comfortable domestic partnership. But the thing about Sissy is she was born in Ohio in 1870, and before she was 20 or around that time, she moved to Harlem in the 1890s. She began posing nude for photographers and artists. This was a very daring thing to do. You know, you had to be something of a libertine to take your clothes off. And, you know, she experimented apparently with drugs, and then she was married, then she was divorced, and then she married again, and then she met Chandler. So when I really started looking at her life, I realized that her early experience in Harlem, posing nude for photographers, Chandler was said to have owned some nude photographs of her. And I felt that this, in part, really inspired some of his novels, including The Big Sleep, where Carmen Sternwood is blackmailed over nude photographs. You see this in a number of Chandler's stories, also drug use. So I think that Sissy was an interesting combination of sexy, libertine, worldly, knowledgeable, and also a kind of refined, classy woman.
As much as Chandler adored Sissy, he was unfaithful to her, especially as she aged. He was at that point also an alcoholic. How much do those two things have to do with each other, do you think?
I think that they're very interrelated. When Chandler began to write in the 1930s, he stopped drinking. He'd been fired from his job at the oil company for drinking and womanizing. Sissy took him back. He became a very sober man. And this went on for about 10 years, and he really began to publish his first novels, get recognition. And then he got a call to Hollywood to come and work with Billy Wilder on Double Indemnity. And that was when it was easy for him to start drinking with that Hollywood crowd of writers. Once he began drinking, he found himself surrounded by beautiful young women and starlets. The opportunities were there. So he fell off the wagon, both in terms of alcohol and in terms of his marriage and fidelity.
You know, Chandler's alter ego, Philip Marlowe, his detective, never does get the girl either. I mean, compared to other fictional detectives like James Bond, for instance. What do you think that says about Chandler's view of women, how comfortable Chandler was with women?
I think it was a really complex subject for him, as was sex. I think that Philip Marlowe, it's interesting that he's one of the most iconic bachelors in all of American literature, and yet there's a reason that he never really gets the girl, because he never really wants the girl. You get the feeling that women make Philip Marlowe incredibly nervous, that about all, you know, that's going to happen is that there's going to be a good hard kiss or an embrace. And then the detachment, the sense of separation, is almost complete and immediate, that there is something dangerous about women. And in 6 out of the 7 novels that Raymond Chandler wrote featuring Philip Marlowe, a woman commits a murder. So women are very complex figures in Chandler's cosmos. They are, on the one hand, put on a pedestal and worshipped. In his own life, that's where he kept his wife. He described his marriage as almost perfect. He adored Sissy. He said he courted her every day of their married life. On the other hand, he creates a hero, a character, who is effectively beyond the reach of women.
Mm. Well, Chandler's detective may be uncomfortable with women, but he has several very deep, very intimate friendships with men, to the point that some readers have suggested that, in fact, Philip Marlowe was gay.
Right. This was a charge that came up in Chandler's own time. Chandler really reacted strongly against this suggestion, and he said, you know, apparently some Americans can't conceive of a friendship between two men as being anything other than homosexual. But I think it's a more complex subject than that.
Chandler sometimes had even more violent reactions to the subject of homoeroticism, didn't he? I mean, he was violently homophobic.
He was violently homophobic in person. Toward the end of his life, some women friends, notably Natasha Spender, Stephen Spender's wife, who became a very close friend, said that they were astonished by the vehemence of Chandler's reactions to homosexuals. And they felt that in order to have that kind of, you know, obvious, vehement, repulsed reaction, they assumed, they said, that he must himself be a closeted homosexual, and that's why his reaction was so over the top. Who knows? I mean, it's very hard to know for certain. It was relevant to me only in the sense that I was trying to understand his marriage and how that marriage affected how he wrote about women and men in his novels.
Judith Freeman is the author of The Long Embrace, Raymond Chandler and the Woman He Loved. She talked with Anne Strainchamps. Michael Chabon proved he was a brilliant young novelist back in 1988 with The Mysteries of Pittsburgh. His publishing career has been a case of one hit after another, complete with film adaptations starring Hollywood heavyweights. So if Michael Chabon wants to dabble in genre fiction, he shouldn't have to worry about losing anybody's respect, right? Then I wonder why the reviews have been so conflicted for the Yiddish Policeman's Union. It's as much a detective story as it is a speculative novel about Jewish identity. Is it just a bad book? I don't think so. When he talked with Steve Paulson, Michael Chabon read a bit from his latest novel.
According to doctors, therapists, and his ex-wife, Lanzmann drinks to medicate himself, tuning the tubes and crystals of his moods with a crude hammer of 100-proof plum brandy. But the truth is that Lanzmann has only 2 moods, working and dead. Meyer Lanzmann is the most decorated shamus in the district of Sitka, the man who solved the murder of the beautiful Froma Lefkowitz by her furrier husband, and caught Podolsky, the hospital killer. His testimony sent Hyman Charney to federal prison for life, the first and last time that criminal charges against a Verb Over Wise guy have ever been made to stick. He has the memory of a convict, the balls of a fireman, and the eyesight of a housebreaker. When there's crime to fight, Lanceman tears around Sitka like a man with his pant leg caught on a rocket. It's like there's a film score playing behind him, heavy on the castanets. The problem comes in the hours when he isn't working, when his thoughts start blowing out the open window of his brain like pages from a blotter. Sometimes it takes a heavy paperweight to pin them down.
That's wonderful. I know writing is hard, but it must have been fun to write some of this stuff.
Yeah, I actually remember writing that particular paragraph, and I have a tendency to rock back and forth in my chair when I'm writing well, and I was definitely rocking while I wrote that one.
Well, in recent years, you have spoken out quite strongly on behalf of what's usually called genre fiction. I mean, horror stories, science fiction, detective stories. You've edited two McSweeney's anthologies of these kinds of stories. And you have made the argument that these genre stories should not be ghettoized, that they should not that they should get respect from the literary establishment.
It's been said, and it's not the case, that I want to eliminate categories or distinctions and have everything be this big mishmash. I definitely, that seems silly, but what I would like to see happen is that the bias, the inherent knee-jerk bias against what's called genre fiction, I would like to see that go away because it's ridiculous. And, you know, most of the great works of Western literature can be fit profitably for a reader into some genre or other than literary fiction, whatever that means. But what happens, what tends to happen is if a work that's coming very strongly out of some genre tradition is really good and is critically recognized as being really good, then this totally illegitimate move gets made where you say, but that's not science fiction. So, you know, Cormac McCarthy writes a science fiction novel or a horror novel or a Western, and because it's so good and it's by Cormac McCarthy, we pull it out of competition and we put it over and we say, no, that's actually not whatever genre it most apparently is. And that kind of exception gets made. I read someone comparing it once to what happens to great Irish soccer players, football players. You know, as soon as they become good enough to play for the national team, then they become British football players instead of Irish football players. You know, it's the same thing with science fiction. What I would like to have everyone acknowledge is that no genre, and I think that psychological, naturalistic fiction derived from de Maupassant and Flaubert and Joyce coming down through the great 20th century masters is every bit as much of a genre with its own conventions and expectations, both commercial and artistic, as any other. What I would like to have acknowledged is that no genre is inherently inferior or superior to any other, and it's a question of what's done with those conventions and not the conventions themselves. That something's being a work of science fiction or horror fiction does not preclude automatically it's being taken seriously as literature. And we used to know that. That's the part that I find puzzling, is that someone like Joseph Conrad or Edith Wharton or Henry James or Edgar Allan Poe would never have hesitated to, you know, try to write a particular kind of writing, whether a ghost story or a sea story, an adventure story, with the thought that, well, if I do that, I won't be taken seriously by critics. I think we used to have there was a time when those biases were just not there, and a writer had a lot more freedom. And I think literature, as a result, was a freer, more interesting place because writers had the full range of all the different wonderful forms of storytelling that the Western tradition has evolved to work in.
And there are certain writers who don't want to be labeled this. I mean, I'm thinking of I interviewed Kazuo Ishiguro when he came out with his novel about this alternative future of when people are cloned for their body parts.
He
did not want to. He said, this is not science fiction. You know, I used some of the conventions here, but you know, I didn't want to have to construct a whole alternative world. I was just sort of, you know, that's not what I was doing.
Well, I understand that because there is a stigma, and it's, you know, if you are a science fiction writer, then you have to go into a special part of the bookstore. There's an apartheid in the bookstore, and there are restricted zones which you cannot pass out of. If you have been labeled science fiction, you're stuck in the science fiction section, which is unfortunate. When you have a writer as truly wonderful as intensely literary and serious and as global in her perspective as Ursula K. Le Guin, sort of stuck in the science fiction section with kind of flashy gold letters and wizards on the front of her book, when her books belong over in, you know, literature with the greatest American writers of the 20th century, you know, then something's wrong. And I can understand why somebody would be hesitant to tar himself with a brush that is so darn tarry.
Well, I'd be interested in getting your take on a recent review of your novel in The Nation, which was very laudatory. But this critic was making the case that great genre writing really only works in the spirit of parody. He was suggesting that you have to subvert the formulas of the genre to really make it come alive.
Right. Yeah, I saw that review, and I think that's an interesting point. It's a logical point. I think it's incorrect. And I think it's, you know, the examples, as I recall, that he instances are Northanger Abbey by Jane Austen, which, you know, is a parody of the Gothic fiction that Jane Austen obviously loved, and Don Quixote, which is, you know, so famously a destruction, a dismantling of chivalric romance and so on. And that this is what he says, that it's only by producing works like that that you can transcend genre. I'm sure he didn't use that phrase, but that is a phrase that one hears fairly often applied to work that is clearly genre work, but that somehow we've decided is good and therefore isn't really science fiction or fantasy or Gothic romance or whatever it is. I don't agree. I mean, I think, for one thing, Northanger Abbey is Jane Austen's worst book. The parodying of chivalric romance in Don Quixote, forgive me for saying so, but I think it gets pretty dull pretty fast. And, you know, the 73rd time that Don Quixote's making an idiot of himself by thinking he's, you know, enacting one of his great romances. To me, anyway, that's not what's so great about that book. What I love about the book is the archetypical relationship between Don Quixote and Sancho Panza. You know, I actually don't think that that's necessarily a very good recipe for great literature. And yet, so there are other ways to subvert than by parody. There are other ways to transcend than through pastiche or mockery. And if you look at a novel like The Long Goodbye by Raymond Chandler, you know, that is a novel that came late in Chandler's career as a crime novelist. He had definitely had time to become aware, painfully aware, of the limitations and the restrictions of the hard-boiled tough guy kind of detective fiction. And yet that book does not parody the detective novel. It does not try to sort of dismantle or explode it. It produces an effect of weariness, of world weariness, of a sense of limited possibilities, and presents them through the character of the detective, Philip Marlowe, so that what you end up with, I think, is one of the most affecting portraits of sort of post-war 20th century, you know, guy, American masculinity that we have in fiction. And it's partly as a result of Chandler's banging up against all of those limits and restrictions, not to mock them, but to somehow fight against them and to sort of incorporate them in a way into the portrait of a detective that he's produced.
Michael Chabon is the author of The Yiddish Policeman's Union. He talked with Steve Paulson. So what do you read? Is genre fiction your guilty pleasure? Or do you hold your head up high in the mystery aisle? Let us know who your favorite genre writers are. Drop us a line through our website. The address is ttbook.org. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. You know those quotes publishers put on book jackets? They're supposed to intrigue you enough to make you want to read the book. Here's one that actually worked. Michael Derda is the best read person in America, but he doesn't rub it in. When our producers saw that on the back of Classics for Pleasure, of course, we all had to read it. And we had to talk to Michael Derta. And Strange Champs did the interview.
What is a classic in your eyes? I mean, what did a book have to make your list?
Well, I think a classic is a book that continues to excite, influence, anger, annoy people, even long after its author is dead. It's a book you can read over and over again. Oscar Wilde said, if you can't read a book over and over again, you shouldn't read it at all. There's no getting away from the classics, but we do expand the canon to some degree. I go all the way up to figures like Philip K. Dick and Edward Gorey. Books like Dracula, Frankenstein, The Adventures of Sherlock Holmes, The Regency Romances of Georgia Heyer, these are important books for us.
Yeah, I think the title of your book says it all. It's classics for pleasure, as opposed, rather than classics that will be good for you.
Yeah, pleasure is important. We do get pleasure from our reading. If we don't get pleasure from our reading, we're not going to read it at all.
Well, so what would you say to somebody to try to convey to them the sort of pleasure that can come from reading Henry James, for example, who's a perfect example of a writer who can be difficult to wend your way through if you're used to more cinematic storytelling?
Well, I do have an essay on Henry James, but not about the novels. So people have all written about the novels. I read about Henry James's nonfiction, and in particular his letters. He was one of the great letter writers of all time. If someone close to you died, you would want a letter of condolence from Henry James. He wrote the best letters of sympathy I've ever read. And he talks about the melancholy of his life as an artist, and it is incredibly moving. It's inspirational to read about the lives of people who have devoted themselves so utterly to what they felt was important.
There's another, there are a bunch of classics on your list, which definitely are acknowledged classics, though some of them are notoriously difficult to read. Edward Gibbon's Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire, for instance, which, what is it, 6 volumes? Even in his day, people thought of it as unreadably long. If somebody doesn't think they're ready to read all 6 volumes, where would you suggest we dip in for just a taste of Gibbon?
Well, there are abridgments, but sometimes they leave out the footnotes, and the footnotes are really fun, where he talks about, you know, one emperor who's you know, he had as large a harem of concubines as he did a library, and they were both for not for ostentation, but for use, as he says. But I think you could just start. You know, the thing about books is you don't have, you know, once you're out of college, there's nobody grading you on this stuff. You just read it for pleasure. You start Gibbon, and if you like it, you keep reading it until you tire of it, and you put it aside, or you put it back on your shelf, or return it to the library, and a year or two later, you might pick it up again and continue and read another, you know, a few hundred pages or whatever, and, you know, it becomes just a part of your life.
That essay of yours on Gibbon is in a section on books you call encyclopedic visions. And another writer in that same category is about as far from Gibbon as you could get, the science fiction writer Philip K. Dick.
What is important about Phil Dick is that he changed the way we really think of the future. For a long time, people thought of the future as this sort of chrome, bright, Tom Corbett, gleaming space stations and just wonders of tomorrow. But Phil Dick said, no, the future is going to be kind of, you know, tawdry. It's going to be run down. Everything's going to start to break, and nobody's going to know how to fix it. Our populations will be expanded. Our animal populations will be depleted. And do androids dream of electric sheep? You know, a guy, you know, the dream of this guy, a guy's life is to own a live sheep. And he made us see that the future was not going to be necessarily better in any way. It could be a lot worse, but worse in a kind of familiar, gimcrack, second-rate way.
You know, I have to say, one of the things that I most admire about your vision of what a classic is, you know, the fact that you've included these writers who would normally be dismissed as genre writers. I mean, I'm a longtime reader of detective mysteries, for instance, and have, without really realizing it, I guess, kind of categorized or classified my reading into reading for pleasure and reading that I consider sort of more reputable. But really, you know, it's the detective fiction that's my guilty pleasure. So it was such a pleasure to see Agatha Christie on your list.
Well, I have also Arthur Conan Doyle and Dashiell Hammett. I'm a member of the Baker Street Irregulars, the Sherlock Holmes group. I'm a great science fiction fan as well as a detective story fan of the English ghost story. These are books that are brilliantly written in their way. If you mentioned Christie. Christie's style, of course, is relatively flat, but it's very efficient for what she wants to do. And she is just, if you're a young writer and you want to learn the craft of plotting, there's no one you could learn it better from than someone like Christie. I mean, her plots are just beautifully done, put together, though the art of misdirection is exquisitely done. You think of The Murder of Roger Ackroyd and the way if you don't know the secret of the book, it's just astonishingly accomplished. She's not, you know, profound. One of the problems in some ways about modern literature is that we think of novels as primarily about characters, that you know, the examination of psychological character is what our novels are about more often than not. But in the past, they weren't. They were all, you know, plot was just as important, and even spectacle to some degree, Aristotle says, is one of the great important parts of all plays and I think of fiction as well. That you get, you know, Jules Verne, for example, is showing us, you know, marvels. These are aspects of ourselves that we need to feed. And if we only restrict ourselves to kind of an official high-minded diet of a certain kind of fiction, then we're going to starve for hunger after the pleasures that you describe as illicit and guilty. Mm. And I don't think of them as that. I think of them as just part of literature and let a thousand flowers blossom, to coin an old Maoist phrase.
Michael Derter received the Pulitzer Prize for his literary criticism in the Washington Post Book World. He's the author of several collections of essays, including Classics for Pleasure. He talked with Anstrain Champs. If it has horses, it's a Western. Spaceships, it's science fiction. A murder, clearly a mystery. But what kind of mystery? Are we talking about some graphic twisted horror by the man who thought up Hannibal Lecter? Or are we about to stumble over some all-too-human failing in a quaint English village, the kind of thing we might find in an Agatha Christie story? Matthew Pritchard is Agatha Christie's grandson. He came to see us, accompanied by another English mystery writer, who's as close as anyone's come to being his grandmother's equal. M.C. Beaton has written scores of mysteries under her own name, and a few pen names. Her series featuring Hamish Macbeth and Agatha Raisin are both going strong, as is Marion herself.
You know what I hate is traditional detective stories being described as cozy. Mm. I think there's something very patronizing about it, you know.
I have the copy of your latest book here, and on the front it says, quoting Booklist, Beaton's Agatha Raisin series just about defines the British cozy.
Yes, well, that is flattering because that's what the genre is called. But
you wish it weren't.
I wish it weren't. The BBC did a dramatization of Hamish Macbeth, which is the other one, and they said we must bring out his dark side. And I said he doesn't have one, you know. That it has to be the dark side, yeah. You know. And I mean, I enjoy gritty detective stories, but yeah. George always said you're formed by what you read in early adolescence. And, of course, I was reading Agatha Christie in early adolescence. So you say, was it because of Agatha Christie that I chose the name Agatha Raisin? Quite possibly. I don't know, but it wasn't a conscious thing.
Yeah. Would you, Matthew, call your grandmother's books cosies?
No. I mean, my idea of cosy is the cushion that you put over the teapot to keep it warm. And I don't think my grandmother's books are anything like that. I mean, I think sometimes, particularly when we're thinking about television films these days, we've gone into an era where we try and display to the viewer that they are, in fact, about evil and crime. And my grandmother had very strong views about justice and good and evil and whether you could turn this way or that. And I think that was why she chose the mystery story to display her considerable talents. But cozy is not a word that I've ever really understood, and I don't really think it's appropriate. I mean, I understand that it's a sort of genre name now, but I'm not quite sure where it emanated from, but not from its true meaning in the English language, I don't think.
No, it sounds rather patronising, yes. I think, and also, you know, as you pointed out, cozy in Britain is a tea cozy, And the definition in the times of an intellectual was a man who could go into a room, see a tea cosy on the table and not put it on his head.
Now, I've assumed always, and it'd be interesting to get your take on it, that cosy was applied because it was a contained kind of story and differed from the gritty modern detective story in that if you read Indridison, for instance, Arnoldo Indridison, or if you read any of Ian Rankin, the crimes that occur are described in much more detail than you will find in Agatha Christie or in M.C. Beaton.
I think I like the crossword idea of a whodunit, which is why I find Agatha Christie so attractive, you know. And also, in my life, I did crime reporting in Scotland, and I've had enough of the dark side, you know, because at that time there were the worst slums in Western Europe. There were the razor gangs. My fellow female reporter got her face opened up leaving the office. And the tenements were riddled with lice and broken stair lavatories. And I suppose I found a comfort away from that in the traditional detective story. That's why I find Agatha Christie comforting, because they bring justice. There's a crossword thing, and I'm a crossword addict. Mm. And then there's justice.
The clues are given, the answers are found,
and
the problem
is
solved.
There's no sort of voyeurism of sex or mutilated bodies or so on. If you've seen mutilated bodies, you really don't want to go think about it. You know?
But Agatha Christie's novels have real crimes.
Oh, yes. I was going to say that Miss Marple is always pointing out to anybody who will listen that there is far more evil and wrongdoing in ordinary village atmosphere than people think. I mean, she actually goes out of her way to say that. And I mean, in the Body in the Library, which is one of the first ones that she wrote, a sort of web of evil is sort of spun inside very homely, maybe comforting atmospheres. And, you know, the evil and the jealousy and greed and all that kind of thing, they're all there. I mean, The Mousetrap, which is one of her, probably her most famous play, is actually about child abuse. Child abuse existed in my grandmother's time, and she was well aware of it. She was well aware of sex, too, although she treated it very discreetly. But sex is never far beneath the surface either. Mm. It's just that in the days that she began writing, people wrote about it differently than they would do these days.
Although you write about it in perhaps the same way, Marion, you treat serious subjects with a little bit of a hands-off attitude.
Yes, well, I don't know. I'm not very good at describing sex, I suppose. I'm not very interested in describing it. It's one thing left over from the Stone Age, you know, grunt, grunt, grunt. I personally don't get titillated reading about it. This is no criticism of people who do it very well, you know. And also the thing about the village mystery is, as George Orwell said, the British fascination with the detective story and crime, the ones they remember are the middle-class ones. It's respectability with the veil taken aside, you see. They remember Crippen, you know, and people like that, whereas the quick slash murder so on that go on the whole time, they just go out of the public consciousness. Mm.
I read somewhere recently or heard a statement that the most interesting crime is not the crime committed by a pure villain, but the crime committed by someone who didn't mean to be evil.
Yes. Well, we're all capable of murder, you know.
Yeah. I suppose we are. Yeah, I think maybe those are the type of murders that are hardest to detect, too, the people who don't actually, who think they don't have the capability, of, but suddenly find that they've done it.
Yeah. Or the people who are mad, you know. Yeah.
Would we agree, though, that one of the things that is most enjoyable about Agatha Christie is that it is at least perceptibly simple?
Well, I can tell you one thing. As an ex-journalist, I was chief woman reporter of the Daily Express when I was in Fleet Street. And people thought writing for example, newspapers like that was so simple. It's not. The more seemingly simple it is, the more difficult it is to write it. It involves a great deal of discipline in crafting the sentences.
I was told a wonderful story when the first Miss Marple television series was made with Joan Hickson in England. I think it was shown here in America. And a very famous scriptwriter was asked to do one of the scripts. It was A Murder Is Announced. And he thought this was easy, and, you know, easy fee-earning stuff, knock that off in a few days. And he did a script of A Murder Is Announced, and his wife picked it up at the weekend. And he went out for a beer at lunchtime, and he came back, and she said, "What's this you've just done?" And he said, "Well, it's a script I've just been paid to do for Agatha Christie." She said, "It's absolutely useless. Go back and start again. Have you read the book?" And he then read the book, and he found that his script was totally inadequate and had totally underestimated the subtlety of the book. And he then strung from the ceiling one of these wires, and he put little emblems on them for red herrings and proper clues. And he then took 3 or 4 weeks to write the script properly. And he was quite a famous scriptwriter. I can't remember his name now. But I think people do underestimate the simplicity. They are very, very carefully constructed and very difficult to adapt.
And the beauty of it may be that it seems simple while being extraordinarily complex.
Mm. Yeah, and they're all quite short. Marion is not guilty of this. I mean, you know, her books are not very long either. But, no. but there are a lot of modern writers who seem to think they haven't really earned their keep unless they've written 600 or 700 pages. Yeah. Not Agatha Christie.
Matthew Pritchard is Mystery Queen Agatha Christie's grandson. M.C. Beaton has written scores of mysteries under several pen names. Her two current series feature the adventures of Hamish Macbeth and Agatha Raisin. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. Richard Price has serious credentials as a writer of literary fiction. He's received an Academy Award in Literature from the American Academy of Arts and Letters and has published 7 novels. The latest, Lush Life, tells a story set on New York's Lower East Side. When he sat down with Steve Paulson, Richard Price read a bit from the book, and he set it up like this.
The story centers on a homicide on the Lower East Side of New York, and in this scene, it's the aftermath, and there's one dead kid, one dead drunk kid, and one sober but traumatically shaken third kid. When I say kid, this kid is 35 years old. It's, for me, that's a kid. And at this moment, the detective who's in charge of the investigation shows up, and he shows up after what's known as the night watch, the people who get there first from 1 a.m. to 8 a.m., and he's getting a summary. So what's the story? Pulling a steno pad from the inside of his jacket. Story is, Bobby flipped open his own pad. 3 white males, after a couple of hours bar hopping, last stop Cafe Berkman on Rivington in Norfolk, walking from that location west on Rivington, then south on Eldridge, are accosted by 2 males, black and or Hispanic, in front of 27 here, one of whom produces a gun and says, "I want all of it." One guy, a witness, Eric Cash, hands over his wallet, then steps off. The second guy, Stephen Bulware, Bobby pinpointed to the puker, hugging himself on the stoop, is so boxed his response is to take a little power nap on the sidewalk. But the third guy, Isaac Marcus, he responds by stepping to the gunman, saying, quote, "Not tonight, my man." "Not tonight, my man," Maddie marveled, shaking his head. "Suicide by mouth. In any event, one shot," pinpointing to the shell casing by the yellow cone. "Home run to the heart, the shooter and his partner book East on Delancey." East on Delancey. Maddie glancing towards the 2 possibles, the multiple housing projects there are the subways. The Lower East Side, too isolated, too Byzantine, for anybody other than local kids from the projects or Brooklyn rollers taking advantage of the hop-on, hop-off BMT subway.
Oh, that's great. Thanks. There's so much in even a short passage like that, and we get a sense of, first of all, what happened in the crime. how cops talk, how police reports are written, and also some idea of what the Lower East Side of Manhattan looks like. I mean, sort of the geography of it and where different people live. What was so attractive about writing about this particular place?
Well, the Lower East Side has been haunting me for 25 years. I mean, it's haunted me because it is actually a ghost town. It's probably the world's most active ghost town. I mean, it's probably also the most historically important neighborhood in the history of America. People would be pouring off the boats, Eastern Europeans primarily, from 1880 to 1920, and they'd go to the Lower East Side. That's the first place they'd stop. And from the day they got there, their job was to get out because it was a nightmare. It had the highest population density in the world. And then it's gone through so many transformations over the years. And by the 80s, it was probably the most dangerous neighborhood in the city. It was basically a drug bazaar. People were lining up around the block to go to an apartment to score heroin. Then Rudolph Giuliani, America's mayor, came in and he said, "It's Giuliani time," in so many words, which means if anybody so much as lights up a menthol cigarette around here, they're getting locked up. And then real estate, which is the greatest crime fighter in the world, needed a place to go. So they rediscovered the Lower East Side. And now it's going through a reincarnation where those same heroin apartments are now going for $2 million. It's become sort of a Montparnasse for middle-class kids from all over the country and from all over the world. It's like a playground for them.
But the projects are still not that far away.
Well, see, everybody knows about all the kids and the Renaissance and this and that, but the projects are still there, and housing projects are immortal. Some of the tenements that the real estate lava hasn't reached yet, unrehabbed, that's still Hispanic, Black, Chinese, old geezer, hippie. You've got the Orthodox Jews down there, which are very self-contained, and you have this massive population of Fujianese Chinese, which are, they're invisible because a lot of them are undocumented, but they're living 22 in an apartment, just like the Jews did 110 years ago.
So is this what attracts you, is what happens when all these people come together?
Well, you know what? I didn't know what I was supposed to do. The thing that really made me commit to write about it is that I have kids, and when they're in high school, they knew the Lower East Side better than I did, but what they knew about the Lower East Side is where to hear the cutting-edge music, where to get the gelato, where to get that adorable Che Guevara T-shirt. But they weren't that connected to the fact that five generations ago, their family started out 100 yards from that gelato place. And I didn't know what I was going to see when I was down there. I knew about the Renaissance, and I knew vaguely about, you know, I knew the housing projects. But there's six worlds down there, and the book is roughly about when worlds collide.
Hmm. Now, one of the lines in there, when the cops are talking about this case, this one guy who ended up getting shot, he's described as committing suicide by mouth. What did you mean by that?
Well, what I meant by that is that you have this mortal culture clash. You have kids from the Midwest, from the South, from California, from Hong Kong, and they've led very privileged lives and very sheltered and very well-loved lives. And now they're bar hopping, and it's 3:30 in the morning, and they're feeling no pain. And a couple of kids from the projects decide, let's go flash a gun in front of some white kids. We'll get $20 for a Chinese takeout. But what happens is that this kid who has never been mugged before and thinks he's going to live forever decides that he's in a movie. And when he sees the gun, he turns into John Wayne or delivers like a bad John Wayne line. And the kid who's never met anybody from the white middle-class America doesn't know what to do. And then the kid makes a move after he says that, and the kid just squeezes the trigger.
What he said was what?
Not tonight, my man. I mean, it sounds like a bad Steve McQueen movie or something.
So what he's doing is he's challenging the guy who's sticking a gun in
his face. But it's fatal naivete meets fight-or-flight reflexes. And, you know, when in doubt, squeeze off one.
Has this happened to you?
Not yet. I'm still a liberal. They say a definition of a conservative is a liberal who's gotten mugged.
Now, one thing I'm curious about with this book, Lush Life, is we know, we the reader, know pretty early on who committed the crime. I mean, this is not a whodunit. You could have written in a different way. I mean, you could have left that a mystery and sort of, you know, built the drama around that. I'm wondering why you didn't.
Well, you know, I kind of have like a total disregard for whodunits. You know, I mean, I'm not a genre writer. I'm not a mystery writer. If I could get away with telling you in the introduction to the book who did it, I would. What I'm more interested in is the why as opposed to the who. And the reason why I centered this book around a homicide investigation is that I found out that when you have a very sort of complex landscape, if you follow the progression of an investigation, it's like a lazy man's way of getting a plot. Just go where the cops go and see through their eyes all the peripheral players as they try to figure out what happened.
And yet, couldn't you do that and still leave open who did it?
No, I didn't want to do it that way because it wasn't like who did it. It's like I wanted to quickly get into the life of the kid who did it. Mm-hmm. You know, the problem with genre writing is it's formulaic. I mean, and that's why it's not respected. I mean, there are detective or mystery writers that I really like, but I think I like them because they transcend the genre. The two guys I worked with on The Wire, Dennis Lehane and Pelicanos, I mean, these guys have terrific social consciences at work. And there's an agenda beyond who killed whoever. James Ellroy is in a class of his own. I mean, the guy's nuts, in his kind of dazzling way. Elmore Leonard is just the coolest guy on the planet. You know, I don't know what that says about American literature, that the coolest writer is 84 years old, but he is one cool cat.
Well, it's interesting to hear you say that because, I mean, there's been this flurry of not just younger writers, but sort of making the case for genre fiction as being as good as literary fiction.
You know, but when you make the case for it, what they do is they point out the guys who transcended the genre, Hammett, Chandler, James Cain. You know, if you're pointing to them, these guys, I mean, listen, Library of America has published Chandler and I think Hammett already. I mean, these guys are... I mean, that's like calling Blade Runner a sci-fi movie. You know, I mean, these guys have really broken the mold, and they're using it. They're not embracing it.
Richard Price shared the Edgar Award in 2007 for co-writing the HBO series The Wire. Lush Life is his seventh novel. He talked with Steve Paulson. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. If you want to hear this program again, check an author's name or find out about a piece of music we used, visit our website. It's ttbook.org. To buy a copy of the program, call the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. Ask for program number 413B, Genre Busters. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour was produced by Mary Lou Finnegan, with help from Anne Strainchamps, Doug Gordon, Veronica Rickert, Charles Monroe Kane, Adam Friedrich, and Mike Ewing. Our technical director is Kirill Owen, and our executive producer is Steve Paulson. You can stream To the Best of Our Knowledge on our website at ttbook.org, where you will also find a link to the weekly podcast.
PRI, Public Radio International.